A rational man does not indulge in wistful longings for ends divorced from means. He does not hold a desire without knowing or learning and considering the means by which it is to be achieved. Since he knows that nature does not provide man with the automatic satisfaction of his desires, that a man's goals or values have to be achieved by his own effort, that the lives and efforts of other men are not his property and are not there to serve his wishes, a rational man never holds a desire or pursues a goal which cannot be achieved directly or indirectly by his own effort. The Best in Bitcoin Made Audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are diving back into the Virtue of Selfishness series by Ayn Rand. And this is a really good one. I mean, all of them are really good, and they usually send me down a rabbit hole of thinking about philosophy and stuff. And I like to go back to this just because I love to attack a premise. I love to go back to the very fundamentals and think about a lot of the terms that we use, we throw around. What do they actually mean? What is our relationship to them? And I think Ayn Rand does a fantastic job of really kind of stressing or challenging fundamental beliefs, and really going back to the very core of it, to very underlying principles or underlying foundations of a belief, and then extending them upward to what their consequences are and how incredibly important it is. How it is that really our philosophy and our values are what lead to all outcomes and all consequential decisions and consequences in our lives. And it is invariably a failure of values and a failure of the philosophy of the people in a society that lead to the collapse of that society. And this is a fantastic one about so many people believe this idea that the interest of different men conflict with each other, that the interest of the individual conflict with society. And she makes an argument that that is not the case, that a rational person with fundamental objective values sees no conflict in the separate interests of men because they understand what interests should be achieved to begin with. And I don't want to lead too much. We will get into the read, and we have a bit of a long guy's take to follow, which I really enjoyed. I hope you guys did. I hope you guys do too. Quick shout out to CoinKite and to Swan Bitcoin for sponsoring this show and bringing this to you. And also, just I've been buying Bitcoin at Swan Bitcoin for ages, and right now, for the next $10,000 that you buy in Bitcoin, there are literally no fees. You will get exactly $10,000 in Bitcoin. And then CoinKite, obviously, get yourself a cold card. Put your Bitcoin on it. Keep it safe. In my opinion, these are the two most important things you can do to have a safe, essentially, insurance policy on the kind of volatile world we have found ourselves in. So anyway, those will be right in the show notes. Links, details, discount code, all that good stuff. With that, let's go ahead and get into today's read. And it's titled, The Conflicts of Men's Interests by Ayn Rand. Some students of objectivism find it difficult to grasp the objectivist principle that there are no conflicts of interests among rational men. A typical question runs as follows. Suppose two men apply for the same job. Only one of them can be hired. Isn't this an instance of a conflict of interests? And isn't the benefit of one man achieved at the price of the sacrifice of the other? There are four interrelated considerations which are involved in a rational man's view of his interests, but which are ignored or evaded in the above question and in all similar approaches of the issue. I shall designate these four as A. Reality, B. Context, C. Responsibility, and D. Effort. A. Reality. The term interests is a wide abstraction that covers the entire field of ethics. It includes the issues of man's values, his desires, his goals, and their actual achievement in reality. A man's interests, quote-unquote, depend on the kind of goals he chooses to pursue. His choice of goals depends on his desires, and his desires depend on his values. And for a rational man, his values depend on the judgment of his mind. Desires, or feelings, or emotions, or wishes, or whims, are not tools of cognition. They are not a valid standard of value, nor a valid criterion of man's interests. The mere fact that a man desires something does not constitute a proof that the object of his desire is good, nor that its achievement is actually to his interest. To claim that a man's interests are sacrificed whenever a desire of his is frustrated is to hold a subjectivist view of man's values and interests, which means to believe that it is proper, moral, and possible for a man to achieve his goals regardless of whether they contradict the facts of reality or not, which means to hold an irrational or mystical view of existence, which means to deserve no further consideration. In choosing his goals, the specific values he seeks to gain and or keep, a rational man is guided by his thinking, by a process of reason, not by his feelings or desires. He does not regard desires as irreducible primaries, as the given, which he is destined irresistibly to pursue. He does not regard because I want it or because I feel like it as a sufficient cause and validation of his actions. He chooses and or identifies his desires by a process of reason, and he does not act to achieve a desire until and unless he is able rationally to validate it in the full context of his knowledge and of his other values and goals. He does not act until he is able to say, I want it because it is right. The law of identity, A is A, is a rational man's paramount consideration in the process of determining his interests. He knows that the contradictory is the impossible, that a contradiction cannot be achieved in reality, and that the attempt to achieve it can lead only to disaster and destruction. Therefore, he does not permit himself to hold contradictory values, to pursue contradictory goals, or to imagine that the pursuit of a contradiction can ever be to his interest. Only an irrationalist, or mystic, or subjectivist, in which category I place all those who regard faith, feelings, or desires as man's standard of value, exists in a perpetual conflict of, quote, interests. Not only do his alleged interests clash with those of other men, but they clash also with one another. No one finds it difficult to dismiss from philosophical consideration the problem of a man who wails that life entraps him in an irreconcilable conflict because he cannot eat his cake and have it too. That problem does not acquire intellectual validity by being expanded to involve more than cake, whether one expands it to the whole universe, as in the doctrines of existentialism, or only to a few random whims and evasions, as in most people's views of their interests. When a person reaches the stage of claiming that man's interests conflict with reality, the concept of interests, quote-unquote, ceases to be meaningful, and his problem ceases to be philosophical and becomes psychological. B. Context. Just as a rational man does not hold any conviction out of context, that is, without relating it to the rest of his knowledge and resolving any possible contradictions, so he does not hold or pursue any desire out of context. And he does not judge what is or is not to his interest out of context, on the range of any given moment. Context dropping is one of the chief psychological tools of evasion. In regard to one's desires, there are two major ways of context dropping: the issues of range and of means. A rational man sees his interest in terms of a lifetime and selects his goals accordingly. This does not mean that he has to be omniscient, infallible, or clairvoyant. It means that he does not live his life short range and does not drift like a bum pushed by the spur of the moment. It means that he does not regard any moment as cut off from the context of the rest of his life, and that he allows no conflicts or contradictions between his short-range and long-range interests. He does not become his own destroyer by pursuing a desire today which wipes out all of his values tomorrow. A rational man does not indulge in wistful longings for ends divorced from means. He does not hold a desire without knowing or learning and considering the means by which it is to be achieved. Since he knows that nature does not provide man with the automatic satisfaction of his desires, that a man's goals or values have to be achieved by his own effort, that the lives and efforts of other men are not his property and are not there to serve his wishes, a rational man never holds a desire or pursues a goal which cannot be achieved directly or indirectly by his own effort. It is with a proper understanding of this, quote, indirectly, that the crucial social issue begins. Living in a society instead of on a desert island does not relieve a man of the responsibility of supporting his own life. The only difference is that he supports his life by trading his products or services for the products or services of others. And in this process of trade, a rational man does not seek or desire any more or any less than his own effort can earn. What determines his earnings? The free market. That is the voluntary choice and judgment of the men who are willing to trade him their effort in return. When a man trades with others, he is counting, explicitly or implicitly, on their rationality. That is, on their ability to recognize the objective value of his work. A trade based on any other premise is a con game or a fraud. Thus, when a rational man pursues a goal in a free society, he does not place himself at the mercy of whims, the favors, or the prejudices of others. He depends on nothing but his own effort, directly by doing objectively valuable work, indirectly through the objective evaluation of his work by others. It is in this sense that a rational man never holds a desire or pursues a goal which cannot be achieved by his own effort. He trades value for value. He never seeks or desires the unearned. If he undertakes to achieve a goal that requires the cooperation of many people, he never counts on anything but his own ability to persuade them and their voluntary agreement. Needless to say, a rational man never distorts or corrupts his own standards and judgment in order to appeal to the irrationality, stupidity, or dishonesty of others. He knows that such a course is suicidal. He knows that one's only practical chance to achieve any degree of success or anything humanly desirable lies in dealing with those who are rational, whether there are many of them or few. If in any given set of circumstances any victory is possible at all, it is only reason that can win it. And in a free society, no matter how hard the struggle may be, it is reason that ultimately wins. Since he never drops the context of the issues he deals with, a rational man accepts that struggle as to his interest because he knows that freedom is to his interest. He knows that the struggle to achieve his values includes the possibility of defeat. He knows also that there is no alternative and no automatic guarantee of success for man's effort, neither in dealing with nature nor with other men. So he does not judge his interests by any particular defeat, nor by the range of any particular moment. He lives and judges long range, and he assumes the full responsibility of knowing what conditions are necessary for the achievement of his goals. C. Responsibility. This last is the particular form of intellectual responsibility that most people evade. This evasion is the major cause of their frustrations and defeats. Most people hold their desires without any context whatever, as ends hanging in a foggy vacuum, the fog hiding any concept of means. They rouse themselves mentally only long enough to utter an "I wish" and stop there, and wait as if the rest were up to some unknown power. What they evade is the responsibility of judging the social world. They take the world as a given. A world I never made is the deepest essence of their attitude, and they seek only to adjust themselves uncritically to the incomprehensible requirements of those unknowable others who did make the world, whoever those might be. But humility and presumptuousness are two sides of the same psychological medal. In the willingness to throw oneself blindly on the mercy of others, there is the implicit privilege of making blind demands on one's masters. There are countless ways in which this sort of metaphysical humility reveals itself. For instance, there is the man who wishes to be rich, but never thinks of discovering that means, actions, and conditions are required to achieve wealth. Who is he to judge? He never made the world, and, quote, nobody gave him a break. There is the girl who wishes to be loved, but never thinks of discovering what love is, what values it requires, and whether she possesses any virtues to be loved for. Who is she to judge? Love, she feels, is an inexplicable favor, so she merely longs for it, feeling that somebody has deprived her of her share in the distribution of favors. There are the parents who suffer deeply and genuinely because their son or daughter does not love them, and who simultaneously ignore, oppose, or attempt to destroy everything they know of their son's convictions, values, and goals, never thinking of the connection between these two facts, never making an attempt to understand their son. The world they never made and dare not challenge has told them that children love parents automatically. There is the man who wants a job, but never thinks of discovering what qualifications the job requires or what constitutes doing one's work well. Who is he to judge? He never made the world. Somebody owes him a living. How? Somehow. A European architect of my acquaintance was talking one day of his trip to Puerto Rico. He described with great indignation at the universe at large the squalor of the Puerto Ricans' living conditions. Then he described what wonders modern housing could do for them, which he had daydreamed in detail, including electric refrigerators and tiled bathrooms. I asked, who would pay for it? He answered in a faintly offended, almost huffy tone of voice, oh, that's not for me to worry about. An architect's task is only to project what should be done. Let somebody else think about the money. That is the psychology from which all, quote, social reforms or welfare states or noble experiments or the destruction of the world have come from. In dropping the responsibility for one's own interests and life, one drops the responsibility of ever having to consider the interests and lives of others, of those others who are somehow to provide the satisfaction of one's desires. Whoever allows a somehow into his view of the means by which his desires are to be achieved is guilty of that metaphysical humility which psychologically is the premise of a parasite. As Nathaniel Brandon pointed out in a lecture, quote, somehow always means somebody. D. Effort. Since a rational man knows that man must achieve his goals by his own effort, he knows that neither wealth nor jobs nor any human values exist in a given, limited, static quantity waiting to be divided. He knows that all benefits have to be produced, that the gain of one man does not represent the loss of another, and that a man's achievement is not earned at the expense of those who have not achieved it. Therefore, he never imagines that he has any sort of unearned, unilateral claim on any human being, and that he never leaves his interests at the mercy of any one person or single specific concrete. He may need clients, but not any one particular customer. He may need a job, but not any one particular job. If he encounters competition, he either meets it or chooses another line of work. There is no job so slow that a better, more skillful performance of it would pass unnoticed and unappreciated. Not in a free society. Ask any office manager. It is only the passive, parasitical representatives of the, quote, humility metaphysics school who regard any competitor as a threat, because the thought of earning one's position by personal merit is not part of their view of life. They regard themselves as interchangeable mediocrities who have nothing to offer and who fight in a static universe for someone's causeless favor. A rational man knows that one does not live by means of luck, breaks, or favors, that there is no such thing as an only chance or a single opportunity, and that this is guaranteed precisely by the existence of competition. He does not regard any concrete, specific goal or value as irreplaceable. He knows that only persons are irreplaceable, only those one loves. He knows that there are no conflicts of interest among rational men, even in the issue of love. Like any other value, love is not a static quantity to be divided, but an unlimited response to be earned. The love for one friend is not a threat to the love for another, and neither is the love for the various members of one's family, assuming they have earned it. The most exclusive form, romantic love, is not an issue of competition. If two men are in love with the same woman, what she feels for either of them is not determined by what she feels for the other, and is not taken away from him. If she chooses one of them, the quote loser could not have had what the quote winner has earned. It is only among the irrational, emotion-motivated persons whose love is divorced from any standards of value that chance rivalries, accidental conflicts, and blind choices prevail. But then, whoever wins does not win much. Among the emotion-driven, neither love nor any other emotion has any meaning. Such, in brief essence, are the four major considerations involved in a rational man's view of his interests. Now let us return to the question originally asked, about the two men applying for the same job, and observe in what manner it ignores or opposes these four considerations. A. Reality. The mere fact that two men desire the same job does not constitute proof that either of them is entitled to it or deserves it, and that his interests are damaged if he does not obtain it. B. Context. Both men should know that if they desire a job, their goal is made possible only by the existence of a business concern able to provide employment, that business concern requires the availability of more than one applicant for any job, that if only one applicant existed, he would not obtain the job because the business concern would have to close its doors, and that their competition for the job is to their interest, even though one of them will lose in that particular encounter. C. Responsibility. Neither man has the moral right to declare that he doesn't want to consider all those things. He just wants a job. He is not entitled to any desire or to any interest without knowledge of what is required to make its fulfillment possible. D. Effort. Whoever gets the job has earned it, assuming that the employer's choice is rational. This benefit is due to his own merit, not to the sacrifice of the other man who never had any vested right to that job. The failure to give to a man what had never belonged to him can hardly be described as, quote, sacrificing his interests. All of the above discussion applies only to the relationships among rational men and only to a free society. In a free society, one does not have to deal with those who are irrational. One is free to avoid them. In a non-free society, no pursuit of any interests is possible to anyone. Nothing is possible but gradual and general destruction. August 1962. Safe and sound my bitcoins are. Air-gapped cold card on the guard. Up above the crypto crap. Bitcoin only, that's a wrap. Account got hacked, or your app did snitch. Shoulda got a cold card, you silly bitch. Sleep soundly at night with the Cold Card Hardware Wallet. Find the link and my discount code, Bitcoin Audible, right in the show notes. You know, we've talked about on this show before that freedom and responsibility are the same thing. And to say that I am free is an admission that I am fully responsible for me. It's amazing how little this is understood and how few people, when they say, I have the freedom of, actually are referring to this or actually have this framing in their mind. Because if you recognize that I have the responsibility for as being I am free to, so many other obvious contradictions fall away. And it's interesting, it kind of seems obvious in hindsight, but something's funny about how not obvious this is to most people. There's a line in this, Ayn Rand has a line in this that says, in dropping the responsibility for one's own interests and life, one drops the responsibility of ever having to consider the interests and lives of others, of those others who are somehow to provide the satisfaction of one's desires. Basically, what this means, in a simple form, is that a lack of responsibility and a sense of entitlement are two sides of the same coin. So if you are admitting, if you are recognizing that you are responsible for your life, you're responsible for how you use your time, you're responsible for what you accomplish, you're responsible for your situation. And understand, this doesn't mean that nothing bad is ever going to happen to you. This doesn't mean that the universe is going to be nice to everybody. Quite the contrary. It simply means that we take the cards that we are dealt, and it is our responsibility to play the game. And when we recognize that our life is our responsibility, it's a completely obvious next step logical deduction that nobody owes you anything. You have your life and I have mine. And any rational self-interest is going to recognize that if I am requiring something of you for my life, if I am putting the responsibility of my life onto you, then I have necessarily absolved my control over it. I have mentally given away my freedom on purpose so that I can complain to you about the things that I am supposed to deal with. There's another great line that says, but humility and presumptuousness are two sides of the same psychological medal, and that's M-E-D-A-L. In the willingness to throw oneself blindly on the mercy of others, there is the implicit privilege of making blind demand on one's masters. And I think we really allow ourselves, we delude ourselves to the degree that we create our own masters. And just as a general, like as humans, that we put ourselves in a subservient position, that we frame our relationship with someone else as if they have control over us, even when they don't, because it gives us the privilege to complain. It gives us the privilege to let it be someone else's fault that we are where we are. And understand, it's a good thing. We should want it to be our fault for our position. The universe brought us a bad ticket. But if your next step, if your next decision, if your future is still your fault, if it's still my responsibility, that is a fantastic thing because that means I can actually do something about it. It is a self-defeatist mental position to say it's someone else's fault, because that means that we have to change someone else for our situation to ever be better. And that's never going to happen. That's never going to happen. We are never going to have other people do, say, think, believe, or want to accomplish for me the things that I want. They care about their lives. They are responsible for their lives. That is all I'm ever going to get out of it. That's all I should ever expect. And in fact, I should be grateful if they are rational enough to think that they are responsible for their lives, because they're going to stay out of mine. Another big thing that we do seemingly all the time, and it's incredible how common this is, and this is why I think one of the most important things that we can do is constantly go back to what we believe, go back to our foundations, and look for contradictions. Like, where are contradictions in the libertarian philosophy, in anarcho-capitalist philosophy? Like where do we find those things that... Because when you go down to the fundamentals, when you seek kind of those systemic beliefs, it is incredible how often we find ourselves thinking from the top down rather than the bottom up, and that we will hold two different beliefs about two different things or two different subjects or two different categories, religion or science, or like I spend an enormous amount of time, like I'm not a super religious person, but I do think about the concept of God and what the Bible, what just generally religious texts in general, you know, something that survives for 2,000 years, 5,000 years, has some degree of truth to it. It has some alignment to reality. So the question is where? That doesn't mean that you should take it word for word, whether it be a religious text or anything. It doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that it is true in some concrete or extremely literal sense. It means that it is true in how it aligns people to the world, how it causes people to reflect on reality. And it's funny because I differ from this a lot than Ayn Rand does, because Ayn Rand is extremely anti-religious, anti, like, faith and feelings and all of this stuff, and she seems to put these into the same bucket, because I think she sees religion or the concept of a god as the concept of, like, magic. And honestly, even if you just take the Bible, if you take some of the concepts and how quote-unquote God is spoken of. I went through kind of a couple of different phases in my life on this one. I remember when I was younger, I thought I believed all of the stories and everything. And, you know, I'd go to Sunday school and, you know, we were a quote-unquote Christian family and all of this stuff. And then there was one really weird point in my life where I realized I was separating. And I was actually really young. I was probably 13, 12 years old, something like that. I'm pretty sure it was middle school, so it was before high school. And I remember there was this weird moment where it hit me that I did not believe it in the way, like I believed it in a very robotic way, that I was supposed to repeat these things when someone spoke, kind of thing. And I remember it because we were in history class, and clearly, there was some sort of a disconnect, and my brain was categorizing these two different things into these two different worlds. And at one point in history class, we were going through, and there was, you know, my history class to me was just, you know, a bunch of dates and a bunch of crap that happened, and it wasn't of any interest or anything. It just kind of was a memorization game, and honestly, I think that's just because of public schooling. It's such a disaster the way it is taught. It's not a sequence of reasons and how things come about, like what were the changes. It's crazy how much more I feel like I understand 95% of what I understand and actually find useful in my research in history, so to speak, has nothing to do with school. It's all after school. In fact, it was about learning really the technological changes in history that actually framed all of the stuff that actually occurred in history into a context that made sense. Like before, I just kind of went through school thinking that it was just whatever this king decided or whatever, whenever people got pissed and, okay, well, now this government system changed. Why? I don't know. Everybody was mad for this 20-year period for some bizarre reason. But I kind of re-went down a lot of those rabbit holes. And funny, it was actually, a lot of it actually occurred after I found Bitcoin and I started looking at the world through a very systems thinking lens. That we are humanity and society is a network. And those, how those network nodes interact, the speed of transmission for new ideas, the amount of evolution that is able to occur, and the spread, the bandwidth of transmitting information, of transmitting narrative, culture, connections, like all of these things are actually crucial. Like, these are kind of the fundamental things. It's when you technologically change the environment so that the distance, the time, the connection between these different network nodes of society, the different people and the different groups of society shift, that is when you have massive institutional changes in society. And then you realize that kind of the decisions of this king or queen, or, you know, this particular rebellion or this particular famine, were really just catalysts to a pressure that was building from a change in the underlying fabric of how our networks were built, how our societies were able to trade. And so you recognize, it becomes easier to see that some huge shift would have happened, and it could have been with like 10 different kings and a bunch of different decisions, and it could have been this empire as opposed to, you know, the British Empire instead of the American Empire or whatever it is. But that wasn't really relevant. That was what led to the success or the failure of any one group or culture or institution in history. But it wasn't what caused the shift. It was the fact that certain groups or people or culture ended up aligning better in their decisions and their values and their goals with the new reality as the network information, as the network architecture changed because of a language barrier being dropped, because of a new accounting system, literally, like single entry and double entry accounting was a huge one, because of the Renaissance, because of the printing press and the bandwidth and ability to spread information extremely quickly across great distances, in technology that allowed people to go over mountain ranges or to sail against the wind. Like, these things were massive shifts and caused, you know, the clashing of cultures that had never been in contact before. The trade of technologies that came from wildly different environments and had wildly different bases to work off of. Therefore, you know, one might have a small change, a very nuanced change in, you know, one culture where one has a dramatic change and completely collapses all of the societies of, you know, one other group of people or one civilization. So I really did not see this image. I hadn't painted this picture of history, at least not with very many colors and not in great detail, until after I found Bitcoin. I was beginning to paint that picture for a long time because I found Austrian economics, and we were going down that rabbit hole. My brother and I were going down that rabbit hole together for a few years. I was rethinking about the internet from, you know, as it had started as this idea, this toy, you know, this cool tech, and this, it was a tool, it was a gadget. You know, my dad was a contractor and we had a garage just full of tools. And, you know, we did Science Olympiad, we built rockets, we built bridges, we did all of this stuff, with little robots and stuff. And so, like, all of it was just, like, fun to play with. But somewhere along the lines, I kind of explored this idea of the cypherpunks, and I started realizing, I really think it was BitTorrent, it was like Napster, and recognizing the massive social movement that was occurring because of a change in technology. And suddenly I was looking at my computer in a completely different way. I was like, this is a machine that is fundamentally altering society. Like, civilization, there's a ripple moving through civilization. There is a shift occurring because of what this thing is in my home. And so a lot of these things coalesced as I was finding Bitcoin, and I really changed my thinking of the whole world and all of history to incentives and systems, and started to kind of cram together, like, try to find all of the contradictions in various categories of concepts and quote-unquote facts and things that I thought I knew about the world. And going back to middle school, is that in history, that's quite the tangent, in history class, I remember there was a moment where we were learning this, that, and the other, and these dates. And then the teacher was like, and this is when someone popularly referred to as Jesus came about, led, you know, massive teachings and caused a huge revolution and all of these things. And we kind of went through the history of the Bible, the quote-unquote stories of the Bible, these things that I'd heard that I really recognized at that moment that I was kind of putting in the category of like Santa Claus and stuff. Like it was just like a thing that you were supposed to do. It was a ritual that you're supposed to just go through the motions of. And it was shocking to hear it in more of a dates and this happened and these are the details that we know about it. A very practical kind of bullet point framework of history rather than the Jesus is my Lord, the kind of like religious savior sort of framing that I had only ever experienced it through. And so when I try to think about the contradictions of reality and why I think a faith is not something like just some woo-woo emotion. And I don't mean this, I want to be careful in what I mean by faith as well. Not faith that like, you know, every word of the Bible is some like strict map of exactly what happened. Like the Bible was written by a bunch of people. There's like 100 different versions of it and they say crazy different things. Like there's huge gaps in the Bible and things that happen. Like Jesus, for the historical Bibles, if you go back, Jesus had no magical powers until like, I think it was like 2-3 centuries after it was supposed to have all occurred. And, you know, he's this hero. He's this crazy, iconic thing. It is practically like me writing a biography, writing stories about George Washington today, like me writing stories about George Washington, and then saying that, you know, he shot lightning bolts down on the battlefield and demolished the British and, you know, brought the holy light of liberty to the world. Like, I don't know, like, why would I suddenly have this new information that for the last 2.5 centuries, no one else had? Like, where did that information come from? And so, just kind of going back to my framing of all of this, and why I disagree with Ayn Rand on that one note in particular, is that faith works. And I don't mean it in the sense that, like, oh, as long as you accept Jesus into your life, like, I don't even know what that means, really. Like, there's not like a practical application of that. What do you mean accept Jesus into your life? Like go to church? Like, no. Like, I think the point is to live a moral life. I don't know if we should call that accepting Jesus into your life or not. I think that's largely irrelevant. I think that's just like a way to say a thing. But what I mean when I say faith works is that it's actually shockingly similar to optimism, rational optimism, for the sake of optimism. And what do I mean by that? So, if you believe that you are going to fail at something, you will almost certainly fail. If you believe that there is no chance for you to get wealthy, for you to have the life that you want, if you're afraid of having control, of having responsibility to take on the life that you want, you will literally never get it. It is a prerequisite to believe that you can succeed to actually trying to do so. This is one of those things she talks about, that there's no lack of opportunities. There's no, like, someone else took my opportunity, therefore I'm not going to get any opportunities. This quote-unquote conflict of interests among men. I think she's 100% right. I think there are more opportunities for each and every one of us than we could ever accomplish in a lifetime, in short periods of time. The problem is, we are either not motivated enough to go after them, or we don't believe in them strongly enough, believe that we could actually accomplish and succeed at those opportunities, that we simply leave them on the table. To take an opportunity is to take on risk. They are one and the same. Very much like freedom and responsibility. I just very recently had a bit of a come to Jesus sort of moment with Pear Drive, because I have sunk an enormous amount of, I mean, enormous in the sense that, like, what I have ever invested in a project before, hiring two developers and working with them for months, like, it hurts to watch capital just leave. It hurts to watch my Bitcoin disappear on something that it's very easy for me to just tell myself that this shit's not going to work. That I'm not going to be able to do what I want to do. Like, how long is this going to take? This is going to cost three times as much as I thought, which I'm already past that. Like, legit, I am already, like, just a couple of days ago, I had a what the hell am I doing sort of breakdown of I cannot believe that I'm doing this, that I'm losing money on this, and I have nothing to show for it. And it's funny, that's not even entirely true. I'm just not able to use it yet. So imagine if I convinced myself that Pear Drive can't work. I'm extremely convinced that Pear Drive can work. But let's say I'm not convinced. I don't know if I can build it the way that I want. Not that the tech isn't capable enough, but that even if I do, somebody else is going to do it better or faster. And, you know, I'm not going to be able to catch, like, any sort of a network effect so that people even know that my product, like, the tool that I built is out there and I want it to be open source. I'm not going to make any money on it, so this is stupid to begin with. Like, I could convince myself 100 different ways that this is not worth it and I shouldn't do this. If I chose to believe any of those things, I would necessarily fail at it. I would necessarily not sign the next transaction to pay for the developers to keep working on this project. It is a prerequisite that I truly believe that I can get to an end result that is valuable, that is popular, that people like, that is extremely useful and solves a problem that bugs the ever-loving crap out of me. Probably my biggest challenge is to simply not quit when somebody else would have. But the belief is a prerequisite. Faith that there is always a path to accomplishing what you want in life. Faith that in your hands you can do this. Faith that there is a meaning and a purpose to life. We are the custodians of life's meaning. Life means the meaning that I get out of it. And that, I personally think, is where you find God. And no, I'm not meaning a dude in the sky that has a cheat code and undoes the rules of physics whenever he feels like it. I mean the purpose and the meaning of existence to begin with. And I do not think these are contradictory to science. I believe that philosophy, logic, scientific discovery, that these things are, like, we are the universe. Like, we're not separate. We are literally made of the universe in the universe. We are the same thing. We naturally, as living organisms, seek to know ourselves and to know the world. We want to discover. We want to understand. We want to explore. And funny enough, when we stop doing that, we literally die. And I don't even mean that as an individual. I mean that as a species, from the context of evolution. When you lose the drive to live, you literally die. Which means that life is literally aligned with the pursuit of love, meaning, and understanding. Because all three of those things lead to more and prosperous life. And despite the fact that Ayn Rand puts that in the realm of the irrational, the idea of fate or feelings, I do the exact opposite. I think that is a perfectly rational conclusion for what the purpose of life is, for what the meaning of life is, and it is directly aligned to the fact that These are prerequisite that you can see this in life, because more of those things will result in exactly that. Death, destruction, hate, entitlement, these things are literally anti-life. The more widely and universally we hold the belief that somebody else is responsible for us and that they're supposed to do something to make our life better, there's no positive gain to any of it. We eventually run out of who it is that's doing the stuff for other people. Everybody is running on a net negative, and until literally the society eats itself. The responsibility of our own lives is a rational conclusion from a universal understanding of how life persists to begin with. And I want to read another quote from this piece, actually. She says, "A rational man does not indulge in wistful longings for ends divorced from means. He does not hold a desire without knowing or learning and considering the means by which it is to be achieved. Since he knows that nature does not provide man with the automatic satisfaction of his desires, that a man's goals or values have to be achieved by his own effort, that the lives and efforts of other men are not his property and are not there to serve his wishes, a rational man never holds a desire or pursues a goal which cannot be achieved directly or indirectly by his own effort." The idea, the reason people come up with this conclusion that there is a conflict in interests among men, when to the contrary, Thomas Sowell actually talks about this a lot, and I love this. Just this simple framing is that there is no conflict between man and society, because man can always survives better with society than without. Like you'd have nothing. I mean, I just look around. I'm in my basement, and I'm just surrounded by like all the crap, my tools, my gadgets, and all this stuff. And I think, what would I have if I was not a part of society? Like I couldn't use or make any of this stuff. Even the stuff that I made, I only made because of all of these tools that I have no capability to make whatsoever. Even with a ton of other tools, I would struggle to make a lot of the tools that I use to make the most basic of things. My interests are not misaligned with society. And if I ever reach that conclusion, it is simply because of an irrational belief about reality itself. And that's what Ayn Rand is getting at, is that it's simply not rational. Is that it is simply a false belief. There is some sort of a contradiction in a fundamental belief that that person is holding, to believe that man, that an individual and society are at odds with each other. When what's actually occurring is that that person is holding a contradictory belief that is completely misaligned with reality. And it leads them to make this assumption because in their own situation, they don't understand how it is that they should be aligned. They are the ones thinking that someone else owes them, that someone else should provide them with this thing, that I should just wish for this thing that's completely unearned, which just means that you'll never keep it. You know, if I wish for $1 million that is unearned, that $1 million is gone just like that. Great example I've brought up a lot of times, a bunch in various conversations and for various reasons on the show, is lottery winners. Having wealth is not just having $1 million. $1 million is just the ability to consume a bunch of crap. That is not wealth. Wealth is a state of being. It is being able to make the right decisions, knowing when and how to take the right risks, knowing how to take $5 and turn it into $7. That is wealth. And it starts small and scales up. But the principles happen at $5 just as solidly, and they exist just as profoundly as they do at $5 billion. The logistics are just drastically different. But if you take somebody who has a poverty mindset and give them millions and millions of dollars, and you take someone who has millions and millions of dollars that they have earned, and they have a mindset of understanding how, and they know and understand how to utilize capital so that it grows, and You make the person who's extremely wealthy poor. You just take everything that they have, and you make the person who is poor extremely wealthy, and you give them tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. In 2 years, they will be back in the reverse positions. The person who understands capital, growing capital, and the cost of wealth will be back on their way to having millions of dollars. And the person with the poverty mindset will be dead broke or massively in debt. And if they believed that just being handed those tens of millions of dollars was in their interest, then it wasn't because rationally it is in their interest. It wasn't because there was some sort of a conflict between those two men and what was good for them. To the contrary, it was that the person with the poverty mindset had an irrational belief that punished them greatly. They're going to be miserable at the end of that 2 years. According to all of those people who win the lottery, who win a lump sum lottery ticket of tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, according to them, it's the worst thing to ever happen to you. So what Ayn Rand gets at in kind of towards the beginning of this piece is that the problem is not that the interests of men conflict with each other or that the interest of the individual conflicts with society. It is that people fail miserably at understanding what is actually in their interest. And in doing so, then hold this belief because of their inability to understand and actually project something that they seek in this world according to their values, to actually objectively define their values and then live according to them. Because of that incongruency, they then think because their interests are to just have $100 million out of thin air or to have it taken from someone else, then they believe that the conflict of man's interest is in competition, that it is only at someone else's suffering that they can succeed. But it's not because it's true. It's because they believe something that is completely false. It's because they have values that destroy their own lives and they do not know it. And there's one other thing that I do have a couple of other quotes, but I don't have time to get into them. But there's another quote that I really liked in this one that is really pertinent to what money does and why it is that when you corrupt the value system of society, you force all of these things which are terrible decisions, all of these things which are actually against the values, against the basic values and the cooperative nature of society. You actually make them seemingly financially responsible decisions. The quote is, "It means that he does not regard any moment as cut off from the context of the rest of his life, and that he allows no conflicts or contradictions between his short-range and long-range interests." When you corrupt the money, what happens is that the ability to economically compare the value of the short-range to long-range interests becomes grossly distorted. And if you haven't listened to the latest guy's take, A Fiat Waste, I highly encourage you to do so. I will have the link in the show notes because I think I make a pretty good argument there of trying to make sense of how it is that it breaks that alignment, the incentive for society to be a source of cooperation, and it forces us into this battle to waste resources as fast as possible because we are bleeding the value of the money, which represents the access to the resources. The value that we expect the money to have in the future is essentially the value we expect on the future of society. It is our way to literally, quote-unquote, invest in society itself rather than in any specific endeavor by simply producing resources for that society, believing that society will become better, and therefore in the future, when I take it back out, it will be worth more. So in the context of, like, Let's say I build three houses for three other people. Then I save all of that money. If that money is sound, then what I am expecting is that those three people with a house are going to be more prosperous, happier, more stable, and able to produce more and accomplish more in their lives. And then when I hold on to that, I leave that value. I leave those houses in the society. I leave those resources for other people to use them for their highest purpose. Because I expect society to grow from the capital that I have included, that I have helped someone else achieve what they wanted. And as society grows, then my access to my portion of it through holding the sound money will be greater as society becomes more productive. When that money is bled of value, when it is inflated away, it causes a competition. It causes a dog-eat-dog race to gobble up as many of the resources as we possibly can, to own everything that we possibly can and exclude it from others. It literally puts us in this situation of scarcity, of forced scarcity, where it is only because I take it before someone else gets it that I get to own it. Think about that from the context of somebody who got to buy a house 10 years ago versus somebody who's buying a house today. Imagine if that person had waited and allowed that house to stay in society. That house is now horribly more difficult to afford, to obtain. So instead, it was a race to get financing as quick as possible at whatever cost, doesn't even matter. The price of the house is going to go up and my debt to society is going to be devalued anyway. I can get it at a low interest that is artificially so. And suddenly we are misaligned. There is no way to actually fundamentally fix that, even for everyone to individually believe the way it should be. The interests of men do not conflict, and the interests of the individual do not conflict with society. But inflationary money literally forces us into a position where it actually does, because it lies to us about the cost of using up resources and the value of those resources in the future. But anyway, I'm not going to get into all that again. If you want to dig a little bit deeper down that rabbit hole, check out Fiat Waste. This guy's take, the last one. I don't know what it is. I will have the link in the show notes. All right, there's still a couple more quotes, but I think we've covered a bunch, and I'm running out of time here. So let me go ahead and wrap it up. Thank you guys so much for listening. And I actually want to close out on Ayn Rand's last words, because I think this is so crucial, and it aligns with what I was saying about sound money, because sound money is actually a prerequisite to a free society. Because freedom is actually secured within a set of rules. Freedom is about self-responsibility, right? And it is only within a set of market rules that a free market can emerge. Whether it be culturally and, you know, just social norms of just, you know, you just don't punch people when you walk down the street, you don't stab them in order to take their purse, or if it's government rules, or if it's rules built into a monetary protocol, into a network, where we are forced to only have interactions according to a certain set of rules. But that free market exists because of that set of rules. And sound money is the most important tool for laying that foundation. Without sound money, you cannot have freedom. Because free society and free trade is about voluntary value choices distributing resources throughout society. And to print money is to violate that entire principle, the whole concept of how resources are distributed. So, back to Ayn Rand's last words. All of the above discussion applies only to the relationships among rational men, and only to a free society. In a free society, one does not have to deal with those who are irrational. One is free to avoid them. In a non-free society, no pursuit of any interest is possible to anyone. Nothing is possible but gradual and general destruction. Thank you to Swan and CoinKite for supporting this show. I am Guy Swan, and until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. The hardest thing to explain is the glaringly evident, which everybody has decided not to see. The Fountainhead.